Do you have an office? Do you work out of your home or what?
I have an office at the New Yorker.
Do you punch in every day?
Oh, no. No, I don't punch in very often. I really work at home, basically. I go to that office. I go less now since I don't do the U.S. Journal series. I used to go in a lot more to pick up my newspapers. I used to take a lot of weekly papers from around the country and to edit pieces. I go in there when we're closing a piece. But now that I'm doing longer pieces or other things, I don't go in as often. And I tend to work at home, which is nice. Coming uptown wears me out more than writing.
The New Yorker, the magazine that I've read off and on since I was a kid, it's such a strange magazine. I find myself, as I am looking at an article or fiction, I find myself flipping to the end to see who wrote it, to see if I want to read it.
Right. Well, it does have a table of contents now, I mean, which it didn't have when I first got there. I guess that table of contents went in, God, I'm guessing, 10 or 12 years ago, I suppose, maybe longer than that. Although now it looks as if it's always been there, since it looks so much like the rest of the magazine. It is a strange magazine. It is a conservative magazine with a low C, the lowercase C conservative, in the sense that if you see a facsimile of the first issue, it hasn't changed an awful lot in makeup, and its values are about the same. I mean, they've changed gradually over the years, for instance, toward long fact pieces rather than relatively frivolous pieces about life in New York.
The ads are the same.
The ads are the same. But even as the New Yorker has changed, even though part of that change is the values that they've only had two editors, and the certainly William Shawn's values are implicit in the magazine. But on the other hand, it's a kind of a responsive magazine. That is, it responds to what the writers want to write. There's never been a meeting at the New Yorker, as far as I know. That is, nobody gets together and says, what should we be writing? It's almost the opposite of a trendy magazine, even though it's identified as that with the guy looking through the monocle, who I've always hated, that Eustace Tilley is. Years ago, when Esky, remember when Esquire had that little man with the white mustache, they finally phased him out, and I thought it was a shame New Yorker could have arranged some kind of suicide pact between Esky and Eustace Tilley. But despite Eustace Tilley, the New Yorker is in a way the kind of opposite of a trendy magazine. That is, the editor of the New Yorker more or less responds, and of course he can say yes or no, so that response is important, to what the writers want to do. So if people say, isn't the New Yorker more political now? Well, the answer is yes, but it's not because some people sat around saying, wouldn't it be better if we were more political, but you don't get very many writers coming up and saying, I'd really like to do a story on the National Horse Show in Madison Square Garden. They're more likely to say, I want to do a story on something more serious. So a lot of it just reflects the writers and the times, and if anybody sat around 5 years ago and said, what should we do a 4 or 5 part piece on, nobody would have said the possibility that the Earth is going to be destroyed by nuclear holocaust. So no meeting would have possibly produced Jonathan Schell's piece on the fate of the Earth, because I can't think of a less likely subject. Somebody would have sighed in the corner and said, oh God, not that again, haven't we done that? And nobody's interested in that, and nobody had heard of it for years. Everybody kind of accepted it. So, in a way, what turns out in the New Yorker is unplanned, in the sense that no great council of policy setters planning it, and that's why the magazine looks the way it does, and that's why it's unpredictable. So that I really didn't expect to pick the New Yorker up and find A. Alvarez, a man who I identify with suicide, or with writing about suicide, writing a two-part piece on the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, which I loved. I mean, there are pieces I don't like in there, but that piece I really loved.
You're still a staff writer for the New Yorker.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly? You know, when I think of a staff person, it's somebody who comes with all sorts of benefits and this sort of thing, but I heard somewhere somebody said, well, being a staff writer isn't really like that at the New Yorker. It's like the right of first refusal or something.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Whoever said that had it mixed up with a fiction contract. A fiction contract in New Yorker gives the New Yorker the right of first refusal on fiction. And anything that's not fact is considered fiction. So, for instance, what Thurber wrote or what Garrison Keillor writes would be considered fiction, what the New Yorker calls casuals. That's a completely separate thing. I've never known what a staff writer meant.
Does it mean a regular paycheck?
No, indeed.
No?
No.
Well, see, a staff person is supposed to get a... I don't know. I'm a staff employee of CBS as opposed to a lot of freelancers that we have, or per diems, people who do drop-ins on shows and this sort of thing. But I'm
well, it's an odd arrangement at the New Yorker because the only people who were ever on salary as writers, I think, when I first got there in 63, there were talk reporters who were on salaries, talk of the town reporters, who were on very small salaries, and none of the ones I knew did talk at the town stories. I don't think any of them did talk at the town stories. They were being paid for that, but one of them was working on fiction, and the other one was writing casuals, and the other one was working on trying to get a long fact piece done. But New Yorker writers have always been paid by the piece. And it's very interesting when people talk about the luxury of being given all this time to finish a piece. You do have as long as you want to. It's just that it's your time. It's just wonderful when they say, God, these spoiled writers, the ones who are given 6 or 8 months to finish a piece. You're given forever to finish a piece. It's eternal. It's just that you only get paid for it once. And if you have some kind of trust fund and you want to take 12 years to do it, it's up to you. I've never been sure how to draw the line between people who occasionally do pieces for the New Yorker and staff writers, some of whom do very few pieces. It's not offices, I don't think. Some people who have offices aren't, and some people who are don't have offices.
They ought to call you like a contributing writer or a contributing editor or something, don't you think?
They don't call us anything. I mean, it's never been a masthead, so they don't exactly call us anything. But I've always decided the only way to, in an American corporation, decide who's on the staff and who isn't is who's on the medical plan. And if you're on the medical plan, as far as I'm concerned, you're a staff writer, and if you're not, you're not.
Do you have an office there?
I do, yeah.
Do you use it?
I use it some, but I write mainly at home. I don't like to come uptown.
Yeah, you get a nosebleed.
Yeah, I don't
above
like
14th
it.
Street.
Yeah, I know. I've been above 14th Street, but I'm above 14th Street now. I've been to Connecticut even, but I don't do it regularly.
Of course, when you go to Connecticut, you have to dress pretty warmly. It's cool that far north.
Yeah, I mean, this is on the way to Connecticut, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I was visiting Ved Mehta a while back at the New Yorker. I'd never seen the offices before, and in some respects, Ved Mehta, as you know, is sightless, and he hasn't missed anything by looking at those offices. They're a little gloomy.
I always said they look like the branch office of a failing insurance company. I do think they're a little gloomy, but on the other hand, the remarkable thing about the offices at the New Yorker is not that they're not flashy, but that they exist. I mean, why do writers have offices at the New Yorker? No other magazine gives writers offices, writers who maybe technically don't even work for the New Yorker. So it seemed to me that everybody looks at it in kind of the opposite way that they should. It's not a question of why they're not flashy. The remarkable thing is that a whole group of writers and artists and even fiction writers, if I think in some cases, are given offices to work in, even though they may do a lot of work that doesn't have anything to do with the New Yorker. Dwight McDonald had the office two down for me for the first 10 or 15 years I was there. I don't think he, except for his review of the Harrington book on the other America, I'm not sure if he ever did a piece that whole time at the New Yorker.
Well, if I had an office there, I'd use it for storage. You know, I have to rent a storage room in a warehouse uptown. You know, it's $63 a month to do that. Be better to store the stuff at the New Yorker in the office.
Yeah. Well, I keep a lot of files there. Keep maybe too grand a word for what I do with files, but there are a lot of files in my office.
What's the atmosphere like with the exit of William Shawn?
I don't know. I've barely been there for the last 4 months. I mean, I go away in the summer, and I've been away since I got back. So the last piece I closed, which is when I'm there most steadily, day after day, I closed from Nova Scotia in June. So
it's really been months since I've been there any more than kind of to pick up my mail and say hello. But it seems fine. I mean, it's obviously more informal because Bob Gottlieb's a more informal person, and I think people tend to, in some ways, take their cue from whoever's supposedly in charge of an organization, although in the New Yorker, that doesn't mean anything exactly because there isn't any, I don't think there's ever been a meeting or anything like that at the New Yorker. So it,
a lot more sneakers.
No, everybody always dressed like that at the New Yorker.
Did they?
Except for Mr. Sean. I mean, the younger guys did. I think that I've never seen any of the younger writers at the New Yorker in a coat and tie.
You didn't sign that petition, did you?
Sure.
You signed the one asking Gottlieb not to join?
Sure.
Why?
Well, I thought that it was an imperfect instrument. I mean, I would have much preferred a letter to Newhouse saying that he had broken several promises and that what he had done was basically crude and kind of stupid. But it just turned out that that wasn't what most people wanted to do. And I thought the notice had to be taken in some way. I didn't have any doubt about the outcome. I think I said publicly at a meeting that the worst thing that could happen is that Bob Gottlieb would say, okay, you know, I won't come, because it certainly wasn't directed against him. I mean, many of us knew him and liked him, and I think it said in the letter it wasn't directed against him. But I think that if someone says, I agree not to choose a new editor without meeting with the editorial department, and then doesn't, that you shouldn't just let it pass. I mean, of course, the wise heads would say, well, that's just what we call in the newspaper business the usual Murdoch assurances. And that may be, but I think then they should be known as the usual Murdoch and Newhouse assurances. I mean, I think that people should scream and shout when if they don't like something, even if it's the way it's done. I mean, why not?
Well, you have a lot more independence over there at the New Yorker than we do at CBS here. They say, you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. That's all there is. They don't approach us and give us options.
Well, that's true. I think that in any organization, that if people don't like what happens, and I particularly in the organizations where there's a constant tension between the editorial function and the business function, such as a magazine or a broadcasting network, that any opportunity passed up is wrong. I mean, I think if the publisher of a major New York not New York, but any city, a paper hires some relative or does something silly over the objection of the editor, people ought to scream and shout. I mean, why not? It seems to me that at the very least they should try to embarrass them. I don't think they're going to get fired for it.
Well, I remember screaming and shouting at Larry Tisch because I was standing on a picket line for 7 weeks,
right,
joining a lot of other people during the Writers Guild strike. And it ended, and everybody's happy now.